It's time for security now. We're going to talk security big time. Lots of news this week. And we'll talk about Steve's new utility, Never 10, and his brand new PC build, which is mind-boggling. I asked him how much it costs. He said, I don't know. I didn't bother to add it up. I wouldn't if I were you, Steve. It's all next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 553, recorded Tuesday, March 29th, 2016. Too much news. Security Now is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/SecurityNow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online with the explainer-in-chief, Mr. Steve Gibson from GRC.com. And a happy day to you, Steve. I'm sorry I wasn't here last week, but I hear you and Father Robert Ballester had a wonderful time together.
We had a good time, and we broke the all-time podcast length record last week. We went over 2.5 hours. You and I have been a little bit on the high side of 2 hours most recently, and that's about where I want to be. Elaine likes it because I pay her by the podcast minute. So back when we were doing 20-minute podcasts, Elaine was very affordable. Now we're at 2.5 hours, and it's like, okay, well, you know, I am occupying a lot more of her week, but I'm glad to have the transcripts. So it's a win. Anyway, absolutely. This was last week we talked about the Drown, DROWN attack. And I thought about doing a Q&A, except that there's no way with everything that is going on this week that there's time to cover a Q&A and all the news. So this is just one of our too much news podcasts. Of course, big in the news is the FBI dropping its suit against Apple, saying that they don't need them. There's an interesting and distressing assembly bill going through the California State Assembly. We got some news just this morning about apparently what very much looks like the origins of TrueCrypt. Just a
good. I was hoping you're going to talk about that one. That's good.
Yeah. A blood-chilling flaw in a certificate authority has been found. Two more hospitals hit with ransomware.
Oh, no.
An unknown problem with the Samba protocol. Some good news on the IoT front, finally. And, of course, I introduced late last week a new piece of freeware that I will talk briefly about, just because a lot of people have been interested. I want to also not forget to thank Paul and Mary Jo. They both immediately covered it on their respective outlets. So I really appreciated that. And then I built, as I have, I've referred to it several times over the last couple of months, I built a monster PC to replace the one I'm using. The one I'm using is getting a little creaky. It is a 32-bit XP. And so the RAM problem, the RAM ceiling is a problem. So I needed to go to 64 bits. I wanted to go to Windows 7. But normally I would wait, except that, I mean, the system I've got is fine. It's been running for years. In fact, it had just until recently, it had been on Service Pack 2 of XP because it never kind of liked Service Pack 3. But I had to bite the bullet a month ago and move it up to my XP up to Service Pack 3 in order to get it to understand SHA 256 certificates. So now I'm on Service Pack 3 of XP, which is a brand new thing. So obviously I'm lagging a little bit behind. But I was worried that we were going to lose compatibility with future hardware for Windows 7. I think I want to stay with Windows 7 for the foreseeable future. And I mean, you know, foreseeable for future for me means a 10 to 15 year horizon. So I needed to get hardware now that Windows 7 worked on, because Microsoft has said that they're not guaranteeing that they will. I mean, it's understandable. Windows 7 is getting old. Why should Windows 7 necessarily run with hardware 3 or 4 generations from now? So that was the impetus to get today, the state-of-the-art hardware today to use for my replacement machine. The point is that lots of people have wanted more details than I provided. So at the end of the podcast, I've got the show notes also broke a record this week, 1 megabyte show notes, because I have 4 large high-resolution photos inside the case of my machine at the end of the show notes for anyone who wants to see. And we'll do it at the end of the podcast so that people who have no interest whatsoever can hit stop and, you know, go on to the next TWiT podcast rather than listening to me talk about the machine I built. So lots to talk about.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I'll tell you what, we only have one advertiser this week, so we can
get
him
the end of the quarter.
Get him done, and that way you will have a perfect clear airspace for your flight of security. Our show today brought to you by our great friends at FreshBooks, and I mean it when I say that. I first became acquainted with them more than 10 years ago. I guess it was like 12 or 13 now. Because as a freelancer, I had a little problem. Came right about this time of the month, every month, I had to send out invoices. What a pain in the butt that is. You know, I would dread the end of the month. And then, of course, then it would come as it is, and I would say, again? Wasn't it just last month? And I said, I'll do the invoices next month. But there's a problem with that. Don't send out invoices, you don't get paid. There's this weird causal relationship. Thank God I found FreshBooks, and thanks to Amber MacArthur for turning me on to it. Little Toronto company at the time, and they solved my problem. They made it really easy to get professional-looking invoices, send them an email, print them out, and mail them. They would do that for you. They had all sorts of nice features. They worked in multiple currencies, which is great because I was invoicing people in the U.S. and in Canada. Now they do currencies all over the world. They've gotten bigger and better all the time. Now they're really your ideal small business accounting solution by creating ridiculously simple cloud accounting software. Everything you need to stop worrying during the tax season. Now, I know it's tax season now, and since you haven't been using FreshBooks, you're going to have one last year of kind of pain and suffering on April 15th. But next year, you'll thank your past self for doing the right thing and getting FreshBooks. FreshBooks.com/security now, right now, to get 30 days free. They keep all your cash flow details in one place so you know exactly what invoices you sent, who's paid whom, and who hasn't. And by the way, they'll send out little reminders, nice little reminders, if people are slow to pay. You know, on the average, FreshBooks customers get paid 5 days faster. But that's not the best part. The best part is that feeling of zen you'll have when tax time comes around, or just even the end of the month, and you know you've got it done. Of course, they're known for their invoicing feature, but they do a whole lot more. With the FreshBooks app now, you can take payments on your smartphone. They have a new EMV chip card-enabled car reader. You can do all your expenses with pictures from your phone. You can track time and hours. FreshBooks.com/security now. I know you've heard me talk about this. And here we are at the end of the month. Tax time's coming. Isn't it about time you tried FreshBooks? FreshBooks.com/security now. It was a lifesaver for me, and I know it'll be a lifesaver for you. Give it a try. FreshBooks.com/security now. All right. Let's dig into it here, Steve.
I'm sure you must have talked about it on Mac Break Weekly, and unfortunately I wasn't able to listen to the beginning of that previous podcast. I was busy running around and getting this all put together. But the big news is that the U.S. government, in a filing, dropped its case against Apple. And so the picture of the week on the first page of the show notes is a snapshot of the very brief two short sentences that were filed that reads, applicant, United States of America, by and through its counsel of record, the United States Attorney for the district, for the Central District of California, hereby files this status report called for by the court's order issued on March 21st, 2016. And then it ends with, the government has now successfully accessed the data stored on Farouk's iPhone and therefore no longer requires the assistance from Apple Inc., mandated by court's order compelling Apple Inc. to assist agents in search dated February 16, 2016. Now, what's interesting about this is that there's a lot that isn't being said because the FBI has no obligation to inform us of, you know, quote, ongoing investigation is always the way they get out of, oh, you know, we don't comment on ongoing investigations. So they're able to just say by policy, they're not going to say anything more. But what was really interesting is that the coverage of this is some of it and some of the best of it is questioning what they actually got. And the best piece of it was a video on the Today Show this morning where Pete Williams, who's the NBC reporter and a very careful, meticulous reporter, he stated
DOJ that, guy? He was their Pentagon guy.
Yes, Pete Williams is also the main legal guy they go to whenever the Supreme Court does any sort of a ruling. You know, they bring him out to explain what this all means. So he stated that officials say that the data they extracted from the phone is encrypted and will take some time to decode.
Ooh, that's so interesting.
It really is interesting. And they haven't, the FBI has not said they have decrypted it. They have said they have extracted the phone's data. Well, okay, that's not hard. In fact, we talked about it last week or the week before. One of the presumptions,
the guy who. You think he got it right or he just, I mean. Is that credible?
See, that's just it. I trust Pete. And if the government said if he says the government officials told him it is still encrypted, then I mean that's the best reporting I've seen.
Yeah.
You know, and he stated it in public on the Today Show and has been quoted. I have a link.
See, that isn't what they see, but the reason I question it is that isn't what they were asking Apple to do. And if because what they were wanting Apple to do was make it possible for them to decrypt the data.
To unlock the phone.
Which would, in the process of unlocking it, decrypt the data. So
correct.
I don't buy it. Because if they really only had encrypted data, A, we know it's going to be impossible for them to decrypt it.
Correct.
And B, it doesn't satisfy their need, their demand, in which case they wouldn't have had to withdraw. I think they only would have withdrawn this because they had to, because the law says the all writs can't be used if you've accomplished the goal. But they didn't accomplish the goal. So I'm going to call BS on the statement, whether Pete misstated or whether he was told something incorrect. That can't be right.
It can be right if the alternative theory is that the government knew they had a weak case. They were bringing some witnesses into the hearing, and that was the readers of this believed that the fact that the FBI was bringing witnesses in meant that they knew they had a weak case, and they may have chosen not to push this and lose on its act issue and instead say, oh, don't worry about it. We've got the problem solved.
Yeah, but they're not going to lie in that affidavit to the court. I think they would be very unlikely to lie and say we no longer need Apple's help when in fact they don't have the data. They're not going to pull it. They can't just pull it because they feel like, oh, we're going to lose this case. If they say, as they did, we got it.
The government has now successfully accessed the data stored on Farouk's iPhone.
Yeah.
So that doesn't say we've decrypted it. It says we've accessed it. So anyway, I guess my point is we don't know. And I'm happy with not knowing because there's no way we can know. But I also, I've been, you know, following Pete for a long time, and he, you know, he made it very clear that this data is still encrypted and that they have yet to decrypt it. So I don't know, you know.
Is there any chance of them decrypting the data?
Okay,
unless
so
Farouk,
of course,
used Monkey123 as a... Oh, but there is no passcode, right?
We know about Cellebrite and the relationship they've had with those guys. We assume that McAfee has not provided any useful input into this process. I mean, and there are some theories. One theory of this, and Jonathan Zdarsky has been proposing this, and that is they could clone the non-volatile memory to essentially a backing store, you know, back it up, then do their 10 guesses and see whether they're able to get it right. If they don't, then they're able to restore from their copy back to the phone and try 10 more. That doesn't work. Restore again. Try 10 more. Now, the problem is, and this is the real issue is, we don't have schematics of the iPhone. We don't know precisely where things are. So, for example, is the symmetric key, which we know is necessary to apply to the symmetric crypto, that the hardware crypto that encrypts and decrypts the data to and from the memory, we don't know exactly where it is. We assume it's in the secure enclave, which is part of the processor. And because there's been, you know, remember there's been some pie in the sky talk about, you know, etching the top off with acid and then using lasers to read the data out and other, you know, really low probability approaches to succeed. So the problem is, you know, I like to know what I'm talking about. And in this instance, all we can do is report on, you know, the information that's out there. And my feeling is we don't know yet for sure that they've decrypted this, given that a reporter with a good reputation has said he was told it is not decrypted. And we haven't ever, nowhere else have we had it definitively indicated that it was decrypted. I would say we don't know. And of course, then the question is, even if they did decrypt it, is there anything useful on it? And there's been a lot of back and forth in the industry, of course, about all this. And my sense is Apple knows there's nothing that Apple does not know about their phone. And they know what the FBI was asking. Absent any flaws, and there, of course, there, you know, Apple keeps trying to keep their phone from being jailbreakable, yet it keeps getting jailbroken. So there are flaws that Apple doesn't have control over. But my sense is Apple is going to continue their forward march to make this thing increasingly locked down so that they would not be able, for example, to respond in the same fashion that the FBI just asked them to respond to at some point in the future, that they will, you know, take additional measures. Like, for example, the phone won't update unless you unlock it. If they did that, then that forecloses this background update loophole that allows them, as you pointed out a couple of weeks ago, Leo, to install any kind of update that they might want to that would alter the phone's behavior and make it possible. So anyway, interesting additional chapter with lots of unknowns in this Apple versus FBI case.
I'm really curious if the FBI will reveal to Apple, and we may never know if they do or don't, the exploit. Because, of course, what now the FBI has done is let America know, well, there's a way in. There's a flaw. Mm-hmm. And, if given the FBI's stand so far, I'm sure they would prefer to keep that flaw a secret so they can continue to use it.
Right.
I feel like we just haven't heard the end of the government's demands for backdoors.
Leo, you could not be more correct. Yeah. You are absolutely right. And in fact, that takes me into the second topic, which is a recently updated California Assembly Bill, AB 1681. There was on the books a law which already required smartphones manufactured on or after July 1st of 2015, so that's last summer, to include a technological solution at the time of the sale, which could consist of hardware, software, or both, that once initiated and successfully communicated to the smartphone could render it inoperable. So that was like a remote shutdown, which I guess if this law is on the books, do you know about that? That there's like a remote kill for smartphones?
Yeah, that's been around for a while. The kill switch.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I thought. And so so this legislation updates that existing law, and that law's been in effect almost a year, I guess,
since last year.
Right. Right. Okay, so what this does is this law is being updated. It was introduced on January 20th, then amended on March 8th and corrected on the 18th, so just recently. And so this has been added to Section 22762 of the Business and Professions Code relating to smartphones. And so in the executive summary, they say, of this amendment, this bill would require a smartphone that is manufactured on or after January 1st, 2017, and sold in California to be capable of being decrypted and unlocked by its manufacturer or its operating system provider. The bill would, except as provided, subject a seller or lessor subject a manufacturer or operating system provider that knowingly failed to comply with that requirement to a civil penalty of $2,500 for each smartphone sold or leased. The bill would prohibit a seller or lessor, manufacturer, or operating system provider who has paid the civil penalty from passing any portion of the penalty on to purchasers of smartphones. The bill would authorize only the attorney general or a district attorney to bring a civil suit to enforce these provisions. This bill would make findings and declarations related to smartphones and criminal activity. Anyway, that's the summary. So this is what we've been expecting. I don't know. I mean, this isn't signed into law yet. I don't understand. I haven't looked at, where this is or what it means. Also, January 1st of 2017 is very soon. If this happened at all, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it pushed back. But this is the kind of legislation that we're expecting to see. The Burr-Feinstein bill still hasn't shown up in the Senate, although it is being passed around and talked about, but I've yet seen no text of it. And from what little I've gathered reading every story that I could find, it doesn't seem very sharp. It sort of sounds a little bit like a sort of blunt and leaves enough wiggle room that it's not clear how people would respond. But this California law, if it ever happened, I mean, is ultimately what I've been predicting, unfortunately, and that is that it would just simply be a requirement that smartphones be able to be decrypted. So,
yeah, you know, I feel like the California state legislature is not exactly kind of a paper tiger. Not exactly. I'd be more worried about a federal law, but we'll see. I mean,
and I think we're probably going
to
get one.
I think what would happen is Apple would appeal it. It would take it to court. It would tie it up in the courts. You know, it's not going to.
And again, it could
probably
end up getting
illegal.
Tied into, you know, First Amendment rights. You know, the whole
Kalia specifically says that the government cannot compel manufacturers of telecommunications devices to do that. So I don't know.
Right.
I think this is probably nothing to worry about, but they'll keep trying.
Yep. So Matt Green, our Johns Hopkins cryptographer, who, of course, has been very interested in TrueCrypt throughout its life. He was sort of the honcho of the audit, both phases of the audit. And it's been he who we have quoted about, you know, his feelings about TrueCrypt. And of course, we know that the original 7.1A code, which I'm still hosting as an archive on grc.com, that it passed all of the audits that it's been subjected to so far. He tweeted a link to a really interesting story that I commend all of our listeners to. In fact, I think I made it a bit.ly link for the show, bit.ly/SN-553. I think if anyone puts bit.ly/SN-553 into their browser, I think that takes them here, because I wanted to make it easy for people to find this article. It is really interesting. It's the what Matthew Green tweeted was, TrueCrypt was originally written by a multimillionaire international arms dealer named Paul Leroux. I'm not familiar with this site. It's mastermind.atavist. Activist.
This actually looks pretty good. This is a Atavist magazine. It looks like a really interesting story. Although it reminds me a little bit of the uncovering of Satoshi Nakamoto by Newsweek. I don't know.
Well, except that I
trust Green for sure.
I trust Green, and what I wrote in my own notes here is that it comports perfectly with every little scrap of tidbit facts that we do have about TrueCrypt. I remember ScramDisk and that, you know, and it's like its early origins. I grabbed two paragraphs from this. Oh, also after that tweet, Matthew tweeted, Paul Leroux wrote E4M, which TrueCrypt was based on. It's unclear if he funded TrueCrypt itself. He was arrested in 2012 or 13. And then his next tweet said, coincidentally, TrueCrypt development ceased around the same time Leroux was arrested. So from that story, I grabbed two paragraphs. The first is, confident in the connection between the two Leroux's, I, says the reporter, burrowed into the world of encryption. Leroux, it seemed, had started building E4M, which is encryption for the masses, in 1997. It followed that a talented young man, so absorbed with the challenges of code, one who had gotten himself into trouble with law enforcement in the past, would tackle a problem as technically knotty as digital privacy. And we should mention that earlier in the story, we learned that he'd been coding since high school. He immediately developed an affinity for computers and coding, and it's all he ever did, becoming moderately antisocial and getting in trouble with the law early on, too. The story that I snipped out continues. LaRue's software allowed users to encrypt their entire hard drives and to conceal the existence of encrypted files so that prying eyes wouldn't even know they were there. After 2 years of development, he released it to the world with a post to the Alt Security Scram Disk board. According to his own account, the software was written from scratch and, quote, thousands of hours went into its development and testing. In 2004, a group of anonymous developers did exactly what Handfer had feared. There's a reference here that we don't have a context to. Handfer was the president of a company that was commercializing a full disk encryption product that was based on some of the TrueCrypt work and was open source. And so what Handfer had feared, quote, they released a new and powerful free encryption program called TrueCrypt, built on the code for E4M. Quote, TrueCrypt is based on and might be considered a sequel to E4M, a release announcement stated. The program combines security and convenience, giving users the ability to strongly encrypt files or entire disk drives while continuing to work with those files as they would a regular file on their computer. So, again, it's from Matt Green stating as a fact that this is where it came from. And if you read through this, I mean, it holds together well. And all of those little bits around the middle of the story where about Scram Disk and Drive Crypt and that company that's mentioned and Handfer. I mean, all of that I remember myself from my own experience at the time. So
I wonder if Green changed his point of view, though, because he's quoted in the story as saying he doesn't know. He says it could have been Paul LaRue writing under an assumed name, or it could have been someone completely different.
You mean Matthew is quoted in the story?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I wonder if he changed his point of view. Does his tweet say, "Oh, it must have been him"? Or I mean, it's a great story. It might probably be a movie at some point. But he in the story, they quote him as saying, "We can't know."
Yeah, that's odd because his tweet reads exactly this: TrueCrypt was originally written by a multimillionaire international arms dealer named Paul LaRue. Hmm. So he tweeted it as a fact. Yeah. So, you know, a little more interesting information. I heard you referring someone over the weekend to VeraCrypt, and I agree. That is the one that people should go to. People, you know, are still asking, you know, should we use TrueCrypt or should we use, you know, or what? And I don't think VeraCrypt yet supports the GPT and the EFI style booting. Yeah. I don't think anything does yet. Yeah. For what it's worth, I'm planning to just use BitLocker because on my Win 7 laptop, because all I want is protection against the probability or the possibility that you know my laptop gets out of my control. Yeah. I just want it well encrypted, and I just want it to work.
What I told that person is maybe they could use the built-in ATA and lock the hard drive lock in the BIOS. Is that effective?
It is very effective.
Yeah, I seem to remember you saying that.
But it can be bypassed by, law enforcement. So
okay.
Because it contains the key, which is unlocked with a password.
Got it.
So it'll beat any bad guys. But there have been instances where those drives have been given to drive manufacturers and they've unlocked them for law enforcement.
Probably as good as BitLocker. I installed the other day Ubuntu on a machine and it has full disk encryption, which you turn on, you can turn on as part of the install, and you can't get into the disk without entering a password. This is, I believe, it's on a GPT device, and it's on the it's on my Dell. And then it also has, which I love, home additional encryption of the home folder, which might be, you know, for some people that might be sufficient, although there would be leakage with the swap files and stuff. But that's built into Linux. We got to get you off this Windows crap. I just don't understand why you continue to use this thing. I know because of, you know, your Spinrite and
everything.
Well,
I'm still a developer.
But you don't develop Spinrite in Windows, do you? It's a DOS program. You're using MASM.
But MASM runs on Windows.
Oh, you're using Brief and MASM in Windows.
Yeah, well, MASM is a Windows assembler.
Oh, okay. And,
you know, so I mean, it runs on DOS, but
bet you find a good assembler on OpenBSD, for instance. But all of
Spinrite is in MASM.
Yeah.
So
get the macros over the libraries.
I would agree. If at some point I'm doing a rewrite, then it's probably time. On the other hand, I just don't have any problem with Windows. I use 7. I use XP right now. I'm not having a problem. Yeah. I'm like the only person not having a problem because I'm staying with an old one that works just fine.
Of dubious security, but that's okay. I'm sure you'll lock it down. I mean, you don't care. It's in your house. As long as somebody's not breaking into your house, you don't really care.
Well, and there's nothing here. You know, I tweeted that I was at DMV on Friday because I had to renew my license. I ran out of automatic renewals, and the photo there doesn't look anything like me anymore. there's been a lot of change.
Did you have
in the
hair
last
in the old one?
I mean, it was black. I had a big black porn stash and, you know, black hair. And I've had people do a double take because, like, sometimes they'll need to see my ID for something, like renting a car. Oh, in fact, that's what it was the other day because I was renting. I had my car in for service, and so I rented one for the day that the dealer makes available. And the guy, like, looked at the ID, then looked at me again, then looked at the ID again, looked at me, and I guess he thought, wow. There's been a lot of change. Anyway, the point is that they wanted my right thumbprint. The DMV, the California DMV, wants my right thumbprint. And so I tweeted that it's nice that I'm a lefty. And so, you know, that's the thumb that I use to unlock my my various devices. And then someone said, well, now everybody knows. And it's like, yeah, if anybody wants my phone, I'll unlock it for them. There's nothing there except, you know, when Jenny and I are going to rendezvous to see a movie. So, you know, my life has nothing that I'm worried about needing to protect. But I certainly want to stand up for people who, you know, want privacy. So get this, Leo. Oh, my Lord. This is just incredible. We've talked about this CA for a while. It's a well-known certificate authority, Start SSL. And one of the things they provided was free certificates that had a one-year expiration. And so it was a little annoying that they were 1 year, but that kind of like kept bringing you back to them, which I guess must have been their hook because they were hoping maybe you'd buy one for 3 years rather than use the free one for 1 year. But widely supported. Now, in the back of my mind, I have a feeling that I remember mentioning that they were being maybe deprecated from some root stores because they just weren't they'd done something that caused them not to be trusted. But what just was in the news was unbelievable, and that is that the method that they use to prove domain ownership turns out to have been trivial to hack. So much so that until last week, anybody could get a certificate from them for any domain they chose. So, okay. The good news is, these guys are probably gone, at least from the free CA standpoint, because Let's Encrypt has taken off and it gives you, I mean, it just solves this problem. But the idea is that a certificate authority needs the person requesting a certificate to prove that they control the domain name that they want to cert for. And so the typical way that's done is the CA will give you a nonce, a random blob file with the instructions, put this on the root of the server on your domain and let us know when you have. Then they ask for that file on the root of that domain. And if it's there, it demonstrates you have the ability to put files on a server on that domain, thus presumably control of the domain. The alternative is, and many certificate authorities give you this option, is to send email to one of the, like the standard email addresses, postmaster, hostmaster, or webmaster at thedomain.com. So Start SSL offers that option. If you don't want to put a file on your root, you can select with the web interface which one of those three email addresses, postmaster, hostmaster, or webmaster at fill-in-the-blank domain.com, you want to receive email, and your reception of email at one of those well-known addresses at that domain, again, is supposed to be proof of domain ownership. It's even hard for me to say this. It's so unbelievable. The web form that they use sends the email address which the user has chosen as a parameter when you submit it, which means you can ask for a certificate for www.google.com. Now, they're a bad example because they've pinned all their certificates and alarm bells go off all over the world if you actually do use a fraudulent Google certificate. But, you know, somebody else's certificate, www.ibm.com. And so you fill that in, and when you are given the web form to validate ownership, it will have you choose postmaster at ibm.com, hostmaster at ibm.com, or webmaster at ibm.com. But that's the email address it's going to send the validation to is actually in the form and is sent as a parameter, which means you can simply change it to hotmail.com. So the verification of the ownership of IBM.com comes to your Hotmail address. Oh. And you go, oh, thank you very much. Oh. Click the link to prove ownership, and then Start SSL, this certificate authority in quotes, which is trusted by all major browsers, at least until recently, maybe even now, I'm not sure, sends you a certificate. A happy, you know, www.ibm.com certificate. Unbelievable. And as I'm looking at this, I'm just thinking, okay, you know, we have a fundamentally broken public key infrastructure in the industry at the moment. The idea that there is no certification, no validation, no verification of the methodology that these hundreds of equally trusted certificate authorities have in the world is mind-boggling. And our browsers trust them all. Wow.
Wow, that's right. So, wow. Wow.
So it was a free fraudulent certificate mint that you could cause these guys to issue a certificate for any domain you wanted just by jiggling the web form that they sent you so that it sent back an email with a different domain than they preloaded in the web page that you were then, you know, choosing which email address to send to. You couldn't choose the @domain.com. You could just choose the prefix account name, except that it was all then sent back to the server and accepted. And so you could change that if you edited the HTML of the page they sent. So it was just trivial to bypass that quote, protection, unquote. Amazing. So last week, we have another hospital hit with ransomware. This one is called Locky, which I hadn't heard before, L-O-C-K-Y. So this is a month after our coverage 4 weeks ago of the Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center in L.A., which was crippled by crypto ransomware. And that was the I'm drawing a blank. I didn't write it down. That was the one we've seen often, that malware or that malicious adware has been dropping on people's machines. So now we have I'm taking this out of order. So now we have, a Methodist hospital in Henderson, Kentucky, initiated what they called an internal state of emergency and shut down its desktop computers and web-based systems in their effort to fight the spread of this Locky crypto ransomware after discovering an infection of its network. The hospital's IT staff posted a scrolling message at the top of the Methodist Hospital's website announcing that, quote, Methodist Hospital is currently working in an internal state of emergency due to a computer virus that has limited our use of electronic web-based services. We're currently working to resolve this issue. Until then, we will have limited access to web-based services and electronic communications. The Methodist Hospital's information systems director told Brian Krebs, who was reporting on this, that the Locky malware, which came in as an attachment to a spam email, attempted to spread across the network after it had infected the computer it was triggered on. Locky has been known to use malicious scripts in Microsoft Office documents as a means of infecting victims' computers. The malware succeeded in infecting several other systems, prompting the hospital staff to shut down all the hospital's computers. Each PC is then being brought back online individually after being scanned for telltale signs of Locky while it's off the network. Now, the good news of the story is that for reasons that are not clear, maybe it's just sort of generic, the Locky guys only want 4 bitcoins in payment, which is about $1,600, which I consider a massive bargain. I mean, these guys are spending that per hour on IT, you know, emergency recovery procedures. And for example, 4 weeks ago, after being down for 10 days, the Hollywood Presbyterian had to pay a ransom of 40 Bitcoin, which was about $17,000. And even that, you know, when you consider I'm sure you know, Leo, all medicine is automated now. I mean, a hospital can't function without its IT infrastructure. And in fact, you know, they're literally reduced to like writing on like stone tablets with chisels. It's just amazing. Now, that was last week. Yesterday, there is a huge health system in Washington named MedStar Health, which operates 10 hospitals, more than 250 outpatient facilities throughout the Washington region, and has revenues of $5 billion annually. Hit with crypto ransomware. They have no access to their systems. The hospital staff in the reporting on this said they've had to revert to seldom used paper charts and records. One employee who asked that her name not be used because she was not authorized to speak of the incident said, even the lowest level staff can't communicate with anyone. You can't schedule patients. You can't access records. You can't do anything. So they're completely crippled. And I mean, I don't mean to be taking this lightly, but it's not. I mean, it's a huge problem. And of course, we predicted this years ago. The first time the concept of encrypting a drive and asking for payment appeared on this podcast, we said, oh, this is going to turn out really bad, because suddenly there was a profit motive for these kinds of attacks. Until now, I mean, until then, it had, you know, viruses sort of existed just for their own sake to propagate and roam around, and there were Trojans that were taking over computers in order to commandeer their bandwidth for participation in DDoS attacks, and we see that still. But now, this is a new deal. The idea that you could get encrypt the network of a hospital and get $17,000 a payday out of them, that puts it into a different league. And these people we could say, yes, backup. It is challenging to keep a real-time backup of something as inherently dynamic as medical records and scheduling and patient history. I mean, the whole infrastructure of a statewide medical system is changing from instant to instant. So, yes, you certainly do need to have backups, but even that, you wonder how current they would be, because, you know, hopefully, I'm sure that any kind of certification these days requires, you know, some sorts of, you know, clear infrastructure guidelines. Yet it's also clear that someone clicking on a random piece of email can still bring the whole thing down. Wow. So today is Tuesday, March 29th. 2 weeks from today will be Tuesday, April 12th. Mm-hmm. There's been a pre-announcement of a major problem with Samba, which is it's Samba named after the SMB, the Server Message Blocks protocol. Server Message Blocks is the Windows network file system, and Samba is a client and server system written to be compatible with SMB that runs over on the Unix and Linux family of OSs. I run a Samba server on my FreeBSD Unix machine at level 3, which is where the news groups and my DNS server are. And then I have IP filtering, you know, restricted access to it from my network at home, which allows me to from my Windows environment to bring up the Unix system in a very convenient fashion. And so this is the way that Unix environment systems are able to connect to Windows-based systems. So here's what we know. The site that is tracking this, that has announced this, is called badlock.org. And so this is called the badlock vulnerability, badlock.org. No one knows what it is, except Microsoft is apparently frantically working on it, as are any commercial providers of Samba and SMB clients and server systems and the Samba project themselves. They say it is a crucial security bug in Windows and Samba, which will be disclosed. They write, "We call it bad luck. Engineers at Microsoft and the Samba team are working together to get this problem fixed. Patches will be released on April 12th. That's 2 weeks from today. Admins and all of you," they write, "responsible for Windows or Samba server infrastructure, mark the date. Please get yourself ready to patch all systems on this day. We are pretty sure that there will be exploits soon after we publish all relevant information. Patches will be available for Samba 4.2, 4.3, and 4.4, which is the current one." They do a little Q&A at the end of this, and they ask themselves, why announce bad luck before April 12th, 2016? And they respond, "The main goal of this announcement is to give a heads up and to get you ready to patch all systems as fast as possible and have sysadmin resources available on the day the patch will be released. Vendors and distributors of Samba are being informed before a security fix is released in any case. This is part of any Samba security release process. Waiting to the respective interests of advanced warning and utmost secrecy, we chose to warn you beforehand so that everyone has a chance to be ready to install the fixes as soon as they're available. Once the patch is released to the public, it will point to attack vectors and exploits will be in the wild in no time." And then they ask, who found the bad luck bug? "Bad luck was discovered by a member of the International Samba Core team working at Cernet on Samba. He reported the bug to Microsoft and has been working closely with them to fix the problem." So that's all we know. Now, the name bad luck is interesting because, of course, locking is an intrinsic property of file systems that inherently support sharing, because which a network file system must. The issue is one of simultaneous contention to resources. What normally happens is somebody will obtain a lock on a file, which is an exclusive lock, if, for example, if they want write access to it, so that nobody else can get a write lock that would cause them to create desynchronized copies. So this sounds like and the fact that Microsoft is involved is really interesting too, because this sounds like it's an SMB problem. That is that like Microsoft is going to be having to do something rather than it being a Samba implementation problem. So anyway, this is all we know. We now know, everybody listening to this knows all anybody else knows, which is in 2 weeks, something big is going to happen. Now, it's also interesting that is this being the 29th, that means that the April 12th is, and this is probably not coincidental, the second Tuesday of April. So that will be Patch Tuesday, Microsoft's Patch Tuesday. And it's almost certain, if Microsoft is involved and has been involved, that's why this is happening on the second Tuesday of the month, is that there will be a critical security update for Windows released on that day. Now, the other thing that's interesting is that Samba and the SMB file system is not normally publicly exposed. I'm using it internally. I have no external presence. And I, as I mentioned, I've established an open VPN tunnel between myself and GRC servers, and that tunnel encrypts and transports Samba. But again, it's not exposed publicly. Nobody. I can't think of a good reason for exposing a Microsoft file system. Maybe there are good reasons, but and if so, you definitely want to be paying attention. I mean, if you for some reason have this exposed, I mean, this is why I created Shields Up. It was because exactly this, because this protocol was being exposed. You know, this was the Microsoft NetBIOS protocol, which has evolved over time. There's a version 2 and a version 3 now of server message blocks. It was once known as CIFS, which has now been a deprecated name because it's moved way past that. Or was it CFIS?
No, CIFS. You're right.
Yeah, CIFS. Anyway, so it's no that acronym is no longer used and is considered deprecated. But that's, you know, the reason I created Shields Up was people were exposing this NetBIOS protocol over TCP, which is what the server message blocks protocol, which Microsoft uses to this day, was exposing. So anyway, we will certainly be talking about this in 2 weeks. And this is one second Tuesday of the month that I will be on top of from the beginning, rather than saying, oh, well, if anything important happens, we'll talk about it next week. I think we can assume that something really interesting will be happening in 2 weeks. And for what it's worth, if anybody is an administrator of you know, Windows networking, again, it's the only problem I could see that could really be a problem is if there's something publicly exposed. But why would there be? Maybe these guys are overhyping it a little bit, but boy, they certainly do seem worked up about it. So we'll find out.
Might be a VPN roulette. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah. VPN or VNC?
I'm sorry, VNC, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Lots of fun.
So, good news on the IoT front. And we don't have much information about this yet, but there's something coming from the Wi-Fi Alliance. The Wi-Fi Alliance are the guys, they sort of have a mixed track record because they brought us really bad things like WPS, which, you know, everybody should turn off. And then they came up with that broken protocol where you two 8-digit keys that would, I guess that was part of WPS. It wasn't the push button version. It was the, you know, enter this code. But it turns out that the protocol was broken such that you could guess the first four digits separately from the last eight or from the last four. So that reduced it to 10,000. And then it turns out that the last digit was a check digit, and so the last four was actually only three, and it made it trivial to crack this thing in no time. So they don't have a great track record in terms of the security design of their protocols, but they're still trying. And the good news is they're working on something for the Internet of Things devices, because of course they're the Wi-Fi Alliance, and our IoT stuff is all Wi-Fi. So they're working towards something called, and I'm sure we'll be covering in the future, this is right up our alley, the Device Provisioning Protocol, DPP. Their little blurb on their site doesn't say much. It says, with the increase in Wi-Fi certified devices available, end users have the ability to add a more diverse set of devices to their Wi-Fi networks, including a growing range of devices that do not have a rich user interface or none at all, you know, like a Amazon order, you know, an Amazon buy it button. Wi-Fi Alliance Device Provisioning Protocol will enhance the user experience with a simple, secure, and consistent method for on and off boarding any type of device on a Wi-Fi network. Okay, so that's very mysterious. Network World dug into this a little bit further and has a little bit more to say, which is sort of interesting. And I'll just share what they wrote, or a piece of what they wrote, jumping right into the middle of their article. And I have the link for anyone who wants to read more. Meanwhile, the WLAN should be protected against intruders impersonating IoT sensors, the real sensors infected with malware. This means sensors should follow the same security regime as enterprise smartphones and PCs, especially where pre-shared keys are used. The sensor's identity should be established so the WLAN knows what it is, where it needs to connect, and the permitted traffic patterns. Identity can be a user ID, MAC address, or certificate. But hooking each sensor in turn up to a PC, for instance, configuring it with an SSID, credentials, and identity is incredibly time-consuming. IoT vendors are applying their creativity to the problem, and we are beginning to see proprietary solutions. But we would prefer vendor-independent standards. And to that I say amen. I mean, that's what we need. We need this problem solved once correctly. So they continue, garage door openers, home thermostats, and the like are often configured by making a point-to-point Wi-Fi connection from a smartphone and entering information on the screen. This model is also applicable to enterprise deployments where an employee is able to stand next to each sensor and configure it. But if credentials are entered on the smartphone screen, they're visible to the employee and prone to error. The Wi-Fi Alliance is working to improve this method. The Device Provisioning Protocol, DPP, will allow an already authenticated user's smartphone to bring a new device onto the network, similar to a visitor given guest access by a sponsoring employee. The key feature is to maintain security, keeping the new device's unique credentials hidden from the sponsor and encrypted over the air. So, again, we won't know more until we get some details on what the protocol is. But I'm glad, you know, these are the guys to do it. Let's hope they get it right. And then what we could start hopefully to see is IoT devices saying that they support the DPP, the Device Provisioning Protocol, and that would probably be a good thing because it would mean that we would have a unified, at least something that a group of well-meaning people rather than individual vendors each making up their own solution would have thought through and hopefully vetted. And we can hope that they're better with security today than they were when they did the WPS mess.
This time it'll have 4 8-bit blocks or something.
Right.
Double it up.
So I created a new piece of freeware. In this morning's Sydney Morning Herald, Adam Turner wrote in his Digital Life column, the column starts off, as Microsoft ramps up efforts to force Windows 10 onto older PCs, Never 10 helps you maintain the status quo. Lunch with my parents on the weekend turned into an unexpected tech support visit when my dad started up his computer to discover it had upgraded from Windows 7 to Windows 10 against his wishes. After months of harassment from Microsoft's nagware, I assumed that he'd accidentally clicked upgrade Despite his vigilance in closing the pop-up notifications, rather than dealing with the Hobson's choice of upgrade now or upgrade later. After a quick online search, I realized I owe Dad an apology, as there's been a spate of unwanted Windows 10 upgrades recently from people who swear they never authorized it. As Microsoft becomes more persistent, Never 10 offers an easy way to put the freeze on Windows 10. It's free software for Windows 7 and 8.1, which makes it simple for anyone to tweak the advanced settings on their computer to ward off the upgrade, something I wish I'd installed on my dad's computer before it was too late. So in my case, it was my friend who I've spoken of fondly on this podcast for many years, Judy. I met Judy in 1984 when I bought my home from her. She's a realtor and was part owner of the house. I've known her ever since. I'm the executor of her and her husband's estate, in fact. We became friends. She introduced me to my wife, or the woman who became my wife, and so on. So we go way back. And once upon a time, because she was a realtor, she needs the multiple listing services. She used to have what she called her modem, which was a TI Silent 700 terminal with the rubber suction cups that you stuck the handset of the phone into. And she would, type something, some mystical query into it, and it would roll out on thermal paper, and all of the multiple listings that met some criteria. Of course, over the years, she went to a PC, everything for a while. Then she was using a modem to connect to some dial-up service for a while. That was on 95 and 98 that I was, keeping her going on. Then the internet happened, and she at some point moved to Windows 7. So she contacted me somewhat hysterically last week, middle of the week, and everything had just become a horror. Judy doesn't understand about URLs. She just thinks, and I know I've made you laugh in the past, Leo, talking about her, because she thinks the Google is the internet. I mean, it's her homepage. And so she just asks the magic oracle, right. The Google. She just types
questions.
I want to
go to AOL.com. Just Google it.
She just enters English phrases into the Google form, and it magically finds things for her.
That's what I do. It's magic.
Yeah. And so suddenly the world, just like her world changed. She didn't know what anything was. Everything, it was a big disaster. So Jenny has safely moved over. I moved her to a Mac. So she's all happy. She loves her Mac. She doesn't know why it took her so long. She's no longer in danger. But this was just a cataclysm for Judy. So, and it turns out that whatever it was that happened, it wouldn't revert. It was supposed to revert, yeah, but it didn't revert. So
that's the real problem, because you will get the EULA and you click yes. And then you're in Windows 10. But if you click no, then it tries to revert. But if it doesn't revert, now you're worse off than ever. They basically screwed your machine up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So I'd been talking about the GWX control panel for a number of months. And it's what I was using on my Win 7 machine. But I'd sort of started not to like it. It was popping up and announcing itself all the time and talking about what a great job it was doing. And I just wanted it to just be quiet. And then there was something I needed to do. And I looked at it, and it's covered with buttons, and it's got a whole screen full of like all of the things it does and what it's doing. And it's like, press this if you want this, and press this if you want that, and press this. And there's like 12 of those. And it's like, I just don't want Windows 10. And so I thought, okay. And, of course, our listeners know that some months ago, I also discovered Microsoft's official solution to this. Back in July, they updated Windows Update probably around the time they were getting ready to add what they call OS upgrade features to Windows Update, they had the sense of adding some new registry hooks that would disable the OS upgrade. So, I've talked about it on the podcast. In fact, I created a bit.ly link. It was bit.ly/no-gwx. I talked about it, weeks ago. That takes you to the Microsoft Knowledge Base page where you can navigate through which version of Windows you have and then which sub-edition you have and x86 and x64 and so forth. And then the point is that you need that upgrade in order to incorporate these new options. And then the problem is you need to use the group policy editor or edit the registry. And Leo, I've heard you mention on the Tech Guy that to do this, but
I love your approach because one of the concerns besides all the buttons on GWX is that he has to keep it up to date because he's fighting a cat and mouse game with Microsoft. But Microsoft has always said we'll support your group policy edits, your settings. They're not going to override that because that's how Enterprise works, and that would be the end of the line. Right. So this is what you've done is brilliant, actually.
So for the people who don't know, and boy, I tell you, this thing has taken off like a rocket ship.
I bet.
If you Google Never 10, it's just pages.
Well,
and
can I just congratulate you on excellent marketing? Because that name is half the reason you're getting links. I'm telling you, is the name Never 10. Yeah. That mainstream media loves that.
So we're at about 27,000 downloads.
Yikes.
And it has immediately jumped to the number one rank of GRC downloads. So all it is, and it annoys me that it is 81K because, get this, 56K of its size is the high-color, high-resolution icon.
A bitmap. Oh, okay. Well, they're bitmaps, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. 56K of my 81 code is just icons.
It's just a few K, yeah.
And, well, and the signature, I have to have a cryptographic signature. That adds 4K. So it would be 21K if I didn't have to carry all this ridiculous GUI baggage.
Steve,
around.
21K, all you're doing is modifying the GPE. Really? You could probably do it 4K.
Except it has a nice UI.
Oh,
a
UI. Nice,
it's got nice color screens. Yeah. You can see what your status is. So here's what it is. It's super lightweight. It does not install.
I love that,
If you run it on something that cannot have the OS upgrade, which would be an Enterprise Edition of 7 or 8 or 8.1, it tells you that you're using an enterprise system, so don't worry about it. Or if you try to run it on XP or on Windows 10, neither of those, 10 already has the curse, so there's no point in telling you that it's too late. XP, of course, it isn't a candidate. So it just tells you it's only for 7 or 8.1. Then it checks the current version of the Windows Update client, which is one of the things, which is like one, it's in the Windows system directory. It looks at the version number, which is different for 7 or 8.1, to make sure that you've got the version number which supports these features, these new registry keys. If not, then it tells you you need to update your version of Windows Update, which it'll do for you. You just press a button. It goes out and pulls one of four files from Microsoft's Windows Update server for 7 or 8.1.
I apologize. This is more complicated than I thought. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah. But the beauty is it all hidden from the user.
Yeah.
The user sees none of this. So it pulls one of four files. and runs the standalone installer to install Windows Update. So then the screen comes back and says, okay, now you're, and then since it assumes the only reason you're doing this is to disable it, it then also sets the keys for disable. Now, the other thing I did, I went one step further. First of all, I verified that the group policy edit, all it does is set the registry key, which means we don't need to mess with group policy. This is all in the registry. So there are two keys that it sets, and two values under keys. After it sets them both to disable this behavior, it edits the privileges on them. The way the registry works is it's a hierarchy of keys in the same way that a file system is a hierarchy of folders that end up containing files. In a file system, the access privileges are typically inherited from the parent. And that's the same as with the registry. So these keys inherit their privileges from their parents, which typically inherit the privileges from their parents. Well, I terminate the inheritance of the privileges on these keys and then assign read-only access to everyone. So all system processes, including Windows itself, are able to read the keys. Nobody can change them. And then if you use Never 10 again, because you can flip it back and forth as much as you want, if you later decide you want to re-enable this, it removes the privilege block, allowing the normal privileges to flow back down into the keys, and then it deletes both values as if it had never existed. In no case is anything installed, so you can run it once, set your system the way you want it, and then delete it, or, you know, it's 81K, you can leave it around. Now, the other thing that I was very impressed by is that in all of my testing I did over the weekend, even if Windows has already downloaded its at least 3 gigabytes of getting ready to upgrade you to Windows 10 files, if you subsequently use this approach to disable Windows Upgrade, Windows' own GWX tools delete that 3 gigs. And so I don't have to do it. So I was very impressed. So
download 81K and save 3 gigabytes.
Right. Well, and you know, the one of the problems that the GWX control panel guy has is he's trying to keep GWX off of your computer. Well, it's tiny. You can go visit it. It's in the Windows System 32 GWX directory. It's about 30 megs, which, you know, it's not nothing, but it's not big compared to anything else. And the point is that the presence of these keys completely hold it at bay. People make the mistake of trying not to install. It's the 303.55.38 is the update. And so they keep trying to, like, they uninstall that and then they hide it. And the problem is every month Microsoft unhides it. And what I looked a lot at the whole Windows Update system and whether I wanted to get involved with that as part of this. And it is just a mess. There's no way to firmly prevent Windows updates from loading. They don't provide the facility. They have this sort of this soft hiding thing, which hides it from the UI, which will prevent it from installing. But Microsoft, on a whim, can choose to change that. And in fact, when they update their updates, these things reappear again.
Yeah. And of course, this was actually part of the deal with the free upgrade, was that you had to agree to updates. You can defer them, but you cannot refuse them.
Right.
Right. So that's, I mean, they were explicit about that. It was in the EULA, but they also were very clear about that, that that was going to be the quid pro quo.
Right. And so, so anyway, I like this approach. This doesn't prevent anything from happening. It lets Microsoft do its work, but it is, in all of the testing, not only does it prevent it from ever offering this stuff to you, but even if it's already there and staged and ready to go, it removes it itself when it sees you don't want it.
Good.
So I think this is a complete solution for the problem. Yeah. It's, you know, tiny, lightweight, and just does the job.
Fantastic. Well done. Bravo.
Thank you. I did find some people whose Authenticode system was complaining about my SHA-1 cert, which didn't expire until July. So I only discovered that yesterday. And once again, DigiCert came to the rescue in a matter of minutes. Actually, I was able to get from them an SHA-256 Authenticode signing certificate. Now, the problem with that is that Microsoft Smart Screen hasn't seen software signed by it before because it was freshly minted. So some people who are installing it, and I put a note to that effect on the download page for Never 10, they'll see Smart Screen saying, oh, we don't know what this software is. It's like, yeah. You just click on more info and then run anyway. And I guess it takes a few days for Microsoft to decide this is, you know, things signed with this new certificate are fine. So this is the certificate I'll be using from now on. So I did want to mention, I was looking at GRC's download page. This has replaced the DNS benchmark, which I wrote, I don't know how many years, but it was like 2,000 days ago because my little counter there shows days since the file has changed.
It's like 6 years. That's great.
2.53 million downloads of the DNS benchmark. Securable is older and has 3.675 downloads. And what's weird about that is that it's not for the functionality I designed it for. It became super popular as the way people could find out whether they had 64-bit capable chips in their machine. Because as a side effect of what Securable does, I show whether you have a 32-bit or a 64-bit chip. And so when we were in this early stages of Microsoft offering 64-bit versions of their operating systems, or even in some cases people wanting to move to 64-bit non-Windows OS, they didn't know if they had a 64-bit capable chip because, you know, they just didn't know what the history of their machine was. So Securable was being downloaded. It was being recommended by lots of other sites saying, hey, if you want to find out if you can do this with 64 bits, go get this little Securable thing from GRC. It's super tiny, and it'll tell you. So 3.675 million downloads later. Unplug and Pray is blessedly is slowing down, only 377 downloads a day of that now, but it's nearly 4 million downloads. And the all-time record breaker is Leak Test at nearly 8 million downloads of that little venerable tool, which people will remember I created to see whether outbound blocking was available in their firewall back in the day. So fun stuff.
Nice.
And anyway, new piece of freeware, Never 10.
At grc.com. Look in the software
so Leo,
section.
Yes. Toward the end of your podcast, the Tech Guy podcast on Sunday, you had a guy who was wondering about the bandwidth of his whole home's bandwidth usage.
Well, yeah, he wanted to know by application.
I wanted to note that one thing I wasn't aware of until I stumbled on it. And I think it might have been actually one of another user of it who told me is that freeware that I had mentioned called Networks, N-E-T-W-O-R-X. It offers a one-button configuration to monitor the SNMP broadcast or service on routers. SNMP, I don't think we've ever talked about it. It stands for Simple Network Management Protocol. And it is a well-standardized protocol, internet protocol, that allows devices or clients to query the configuration or current status of network-connected devices. And so, for example, many devices, all of the devices I have, you know, like at higher-end devices, all support SNMP. It's an option that you can install even in Windows and make your Windows device SNMP queryable. And it uses this weird OID naming convention where it's really, really long strings of decimal digits, you know, 3.1.2.7.6.5.4.7.22, you know, it's just this, it's like crazy. Nobody memorizes them. You just use a dictionary to look them up. But they're universally standardized, so much so that it's possible for an SNMP client, which Networks is, to know how, without any configuration, to know how to ask your router, your main border router, for the number of packets or bytes, the number of bytes it has sent and received on its WAN interface. So that's the way I've configured my copy of Networks, no longer monitoring my own system's interface. I have it instead querying through SNMP the WAN interface on my main border router. So I'm able to look at the instantaneous incoming and outgoing traffic on the entire network. But then Networks goes a step further because it has a ton of bandwidth management features where it's able to accrue this over time and with like monthly usage and daily usage and hourly and break it down and give you all kinds of controls. So I just wanted to let the question on the weekend prompted me to remember that I had not ever mentioned this on the podcast, and I wanted everyone to know because it's really cool the way it works. It just, you know, you press a button and suddenly you're looking at your router's WAN interface no matter what router you have because they publish SNMP on the LAN side.
Really great. Yeah. If you forget your login, you can always do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is so random, but the TemPerfect mugs are reportedly weeks away.
Yeah, sure.
And I'll tell you, Leo, this whole crowdfunded thing is such a mixed blessing.
Have we learned our lesson?
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are some good things. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm glad that I, at the time, back then, what was it, 3 years ago or something, I bit the bullet and bought like the $300 Darth Vader black special coating thingamajig. Because to read these guys' postings, they are amped. They are so happy with I know. We'll see.
Steve,
we'll see.
Have you learned nothing?
I'm the eternal optimist.
You know, but let me tell you a happy story, because I did kick in on the Oculus Rift when it was a Kickstarter, and I got the dev edition. And, you know, it was funky. I think I gave it to Chris, our intern, a year or two ago. You know, he was really excited about it. I doubt he's even doing anything with it. And then they got bought by Facebook for billions of dollars. And I thought, well, so much for that. And I'm glad they used my money wisely. But I was so gratified that they are sending. In fact, I just got an email. It's going to come this week. Sending me the release version. And everybody who kicked in on Kickstarter, they have no obligation to do so. It's probably a significant cost to them. But all of the people who supported Oculus early on are going to get, or before anybody else, I think, going to get a Rift. So I think that's, yeah, that's, so there are some happy stories. Whether I'll ever see my floating bonsai tree is another matter, but.
I did get my, the Neuroon, N-U-R-O-O-N, I think it is. It's a sleep mask that also does EEG, and it's got LEDs that are supposed to, like, wake you up at the right time. And it's like, okay, well, I haven't bought, I've had it for a few weeks, and I haven't bothered yet because I'm so happy with the Zio, which, you know, I'm using, and I know how to read
it. That's the big problem, is sometimes these things take so much longer. Like, I ordered, like, a $100 modular smartphone case called the Next Pack, and I'm going to get it, I think, in the next few months. But the problem is, I ordered it 2 years ago. It's going to be for a phone I haven't used in a year and a half, and it won't fit anything I've got.
Yeah,
but I'll have it.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly the takeaway is that, you know, amateur, well-meaning amateurs who are, you know, creating ambitious products, they may succeed, they may fail. We hope that it works out, but boy, it normally takes a lot longer than, well,
it's
hard.
You know,
that's the experience with any big complex project. These things take longer than one expects.
Right. It's hard.
Okay. So anybody listening who is not interested in the machine I built,
can tune out now. Okay. Everybody's leaving.
Yes.
Go ahead. Get out of here. Goodbye.
You got all the
news.
They're
all leaving. They're like rats deserting a sinking PC.
That's fine. I don't want to bore anybody with details of the box I built.
No, I'm really interested. You know, we're building one too.
We're
building it for the Oculus Rift. But I have a feeling we're probably doing something fairly similar. So,
well, there are some differences because I heard you mention liquid cooling.
Yeah.
And I went with air cooling. So anyway, just to finish that, anybody who's not interested, this is the end of the podcast. You've got all the news for the week. You're warned about the sky falling 2 weeks from now with Samba. We'll be on top of the second Tuesday. We'll probably do a Q&A next week. So please feel free to hit stop. And we'll wait. We'll pause now for a minute for you to do that.
Okay, is everybody gone?
All right.
Okay, now we can talk.
All right. They've all left.
Nobody
now.
So
now we just have the people who care.
Everybody cares. Go ahead.
So, as I mentioned at the top of the show, my goal was to build what I'm calling my last PC. It could very well be. I generally build these things, I build them infrequently, and when I do, because I don't want to spend time building them every year or two, I build them to last, and I build them not only to last in terms of endurance, but like I go to the top end as I am able at the time, so that I'm, you know, when I start using it, I'm off to a good start. And
you future,
however much
it's called
RAM,
future proofing.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Exactly that. So, so that was the goal with this. I have had very good luck with Silverstone cases. Those are the ones. Silverstone specializes in home theater PC cases. So they're large, easy to work with. They have both pedestal and desktop. I wanted a desktop case because I wanted to get it up off the ground. The ground tends to be a little dusty down there, and I like having it up on my desk. The other thing these cases are is extremely quiet and also lots of ventilation. So some of my criteria were, I wanted it to be desktop. I wanted lots of large fanability on the case, and for it to absolutely run quietly so that I mean, literally couldn't tell that it was on. I've never messed with water cooling, so I just thought, you know, that's a bridge I don't want to cross. So I went with a high capacity large tower cooler that would fit in the case. And in fact, the first picture of the picture shows the one.
This looks like an engine block from a 56 Chevy is what this looks like. This is now, like a radiator from a truck.
Yeah. Now that shows the one fan with the radiators on both sides. And this is a company, I don't see the name anywhere. Noctua, Noctua.at. Noctua. And these guys make fabulous cooling stuff. Now, the way I set it up, as we will see in a later picture, is actually, and they provide the clips for it, is another fan on the inside of the inner radiator. So it's essentially sort of the middle fan is a push me pull you. It's sucking air through the outboard radiator and then pushing it through the inboard. But I thought, if one fan is good, two is better. So I mounted another fan on the inside radiator to give a little more pull. Now, the next picture on the show notes is the inside of the case looking into it. I ended up replacing those two large fans that you can see at the top of the picture with Noctua fans. I went completely Noctua throughout after doing some research. They're all hydrodynamic bearings, super quiet, super long life. Basically, there's no... It is a dynamic fluid bearing that is closed and just will go forever. So this case features basically one whole side of it is two 120 millimeter fans. You can see down at the bottom an 80 millimeter, actually I think it's a 95 millimeter fan opening at the bottom. And the concept is that air moves in this picture from the top to the bottom, and because the front on this picture is facing to the right, it's moving from the right through the left. But so I'm very conscious of air moving through the case from, you know, in one side and out the other. And there is another pair of 80 millimeter fan openings above the whole IO port region. Also notice that the RAM sockets are aligned with the airflow also, so that the air will be flowing through and along with the orientation of the RAM, not fighting against it, which is also important. So in the next picture, we can see I've mounted the two 3 terabyte hard drives. Those are mounted to the inside of the front panel of the case. And I used, again, because I want to keep them cool, I had really good experience when I was using large drives in my expanded TiVo Series 1s. I mounted heat sinks on the drives and then fans on top of the heat sinks. And I was amazed how much cooler they kept the drives. So in this case, what I've done, since I have airflow, now the case has been switched around in this photo. So the air is flowing up the screen from those two. And you can see that I've switched all to Noctua fans. So there's the two big 120 millimeter fans on the bottom. Now the heat sink, the processor and the heat sink are mounted. So you can see the heat sink for the processor is right in front of the fans, taking the external air, which is being brought in from those two fans, propelling that air through the two big radiators into the inside. And then that air is being pulled out, actively pulled out by the smaller fan the 95 millimeter fan up at the top, and that's deliberately turned around to make sure that it's pushing air out rather than pulling it in. And also the two fans over the IO area, the two 80 millimeter fans, those are arranged also backwards, so they're pushing air out the back of the case rather than pulling it in. So the only air coming in is are the two largest 120 millimeter fans. All the other fans are pushing it out, and the heat sink is the processor heat sink is right there taking the incoming cool air and pushing it through.
I'm a little worried though. You have a lot. You're going to have some turbulence in there because you don't have a straight through flow. You've got fans sucking here and here and pushing there and there.
Yeah.
Before you turn this on, you're going to have to blow some cigarette smoke in there and see what happens. So, I'm not kidding, because you can actually have too many fans, as you. I'm telling you, you know this.
Yep.
And you really want to make sure you have a. You may not need as many fans as long as you have a good, consistent, free flow.
Correct.
And blow a little smoke in there, some incense, you know, whatever.
it is because of the coming in the bottom and going out the top that the heat sinks. What I used for the hard drives is I used the same heat sinks that I had once used, this big, beautiful, massive copper heat sinks, where the fins
beautiful.
Of the heat
sink.
Yeah, the fins of the heat sink are aligned with the airflow, the in from the bottom out through the top. And I used a thermally conductive epoxy. It's like $5 on Amazon. So it's actually epoxy, a two-part compound you mix and then, you know, smear around and sets in about 5 minutes. And so they're just on there forever. So those are the two 3 terabyte drives that are mirrored, which are the sort of the master image backup of the system.
It's funny. That's exactly what we're doing. And I presume you have an SSD in there as well.
Well, I was just going to say, look there. It's right there in the picture.
Yeah.
You can see it sitting right in the middle of the four silvered sockets.
Oh, yes.
Is the same one we bought.
Yep.
Yep. The Samsung 920. And so that's the M. 950.
Yeah.
Which is a 512
great minds.
Gig
that's exactly
SSD.
What we got. Yep.
And so it's in the M.2 socket, so it's right on. So it's a PCIe interface. It is blazingly fast.
Oh yeah.
And so it has a direct serial bus to the processor, and then if we go down to the next picture, we can see the one other thing that I wanted, and that was graphics I/O. I didn't mention that the board
are
I
you
chose
playing video games. Now this you've gone way beyond. This you're doing SLI. We're not doing that.
Well, no, I'm actually not.
Oh, it's not two cards. It looks like two cards.
Well, yeah, there are two cards,
but
they're not SLI. They're each quad HDMI.
Oh, you got Quadros in there. Oh,
yes,
I get it. Okay.
Exactly.
So
because
that's
for
more
example,
for graphics design than gaming.
Well, it's the way I roll. Like right now, Leo, I've got a screen in front of me when I look down, which is my main working screen. Up here is normally TweetDeck, but it's also a second instance of Firefox with a bunch of tabs. I've got Firefox always open here as my portal to the world. This screen up here is monitoring the server with you know, charts showing everything that's going on at GRC. Over here is sort of a scratch screen where Explorer is open in order to allow me to move
you're
files.
You're going
to
have four monitors, is what you're telling me.
Well, I have five here, and this system will drive eight.
Eight monitors.
Yeah. And then the only other thing is you can see that I ran eSATA out to a clip on the back.
Yep.
I also ran a bunch of USB 2 and two ports of USB 3 out the back.
Nice.
So other than that, I mean, and that is it, finished and working.
Looks good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
it
so,
looks really good. And
I didn't mention that
people don't pay enough attention to the heat from the hard drives. I think that's really smart. to put radiators on the hard drives.
And it's amazing what a difference it makes. That's the point I wanted to make, was just giving them a chance to shed their heat makes an incredible, it just like drops the temperature 20 degrees. It's like, in fact, sometimes the drives are like, when I had a fan on the heat sink, I don't hear, but the drive was actually cold because the fan was pulling heat out aggressively through the heat sink. Mm-hmm. So this is just a passive radiation of heat from the drives, but it'll just keep them running cooler.
How noisy is this thing?
This thing will never go. I never.
It's not noisy.
This, no, makes no sound at all.
Oh, interesting.
It's absolutely
they're big old fans,
silent.
So that keeps them quiet.
And then the last page is a picture of the BIOS screen showing it running, where the processor. So there are 8 cores because it is an octo core. It's an 8-core i7 with the largest cache that they had that Intel made. I think the chip was $1,200 or something.
Wow! Holy moly!
And you can see that I'm clocking them all at 4.3 gigahertz. So
you got the K variety, which is unlocked, so you can do that.
Yep. So it's unlocked. And so the reason I'm a little uncomfortable with the motherboard.
Jeez,
yeah. So
that's so funny.
Yeah. So this
why are
is
you
showing,
uncomfortable with the motherboard?
Well, because I would like to be able to drive 128 gig of RAM at 3200
right.
megahertz.
Right.
And what you can see in this picture. Is every other slot is occupied, 1, 3, 5, and 7. They each have 16 gigs. So I have a total of, and I'm not saying only, but well, half of what the motherboard could hold of 64
gigs. I think 64
gigs.
Is enough.
I think it is.
I don't think and so, you're really running. I mean, what are you going to run on this thing?
Well, we'll see. I want to make this for a happy place for virtual machines to run, and VMs take up a lot of space.
Right.
You know, each VM wants to have its own 4 gigs
right.
to play around in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So that was my plan. Now what I found was if I fully populate the board with 128 megs, I can even though the RAM is 3200 RAM. The capacitive load of the additional chips forces me to bring it down to 2.66 gigahertz.
Yeah.
So I can run 128 gigs of RAM at 2.66 gigahertz stably, or 64, I run half that much, 64 gigs at 3.2. So my choice is 64, as you note, is probably plenty.
Yeah.
But if I ever need more, I have the RAM. I'm going to keep it. And I could always add it to the motherboard and then slow the RAM down if I ever, you know, if 64 gigs is ever insufficient.
Smart man.
So anyway, that's the machine I built.
I think you will never buy another computer. I think I agree with you. I can't, I mean... It'll be purpose built for something like VR. This, for instance, you couldn't run an Oculus Rift on this,
no,
because you chose Quadros. I mean, well, not that you didn't spend a lot on your GPUs, but they're just not, you know.
The motherboard I bought is
SLI,
is an SLI motherboard,
yeah.
And that's one other So a lot of people have asked, you know, what motherboard did you choose? The reason I'm unsure about it, and I almost scrapped it and tried another one.
We got the Asus, which I really like.
And so I don't know if it ought to be able to drive 128 gig at 3.2 gigahertz.
I think we have the same thing. I think we're using 2800 RAM for the same reason. I'll have to ask Ryan Schrout. I think that's not the motherboard specific. Maybe it is. You think it's electrical, like it just doesn't have enough voltage to do it, or?
Well, it's drive. It's the idea is that it's driving 4 DIMMs
right.
at 3.2 gigahertz. But when I put 8 in, it can't do it.
Right.
And so I have to slow it down.
Yeah.
And so that says that there's a capacitive load that, and it just isn't able to, because of the additional capacitance created by the additional memory, that the processor just doesn't have the instantaneous current to charge and discharge the wires fast enough.
We talked about this, and I don't remember it, but if you go back to the new screensavers a couple of weeks ago when Ryan talked, we talked about the memory we put in. I that sounds familiar, and I know we're using 2800, so I think that that sounds right. I think he said we could, if we put more RAM in, we'd have to, you know,
slow it down.
Slow it down. Yeah. Yeah.
And the other problem with this motherboard is because it is an SLI, that is, because it assumes you're going to be putting in a powerful powerful video.
Yeah.
It has none of its own, and so most.
Oh, interesting. We have motherboard video. I mean, it's like comes with the territory. It's like
I know
they throw it in for free. So,
yeah, and so it's like I missed that when I bought the board. It's like what? No built-in video. Yeah. It doesn't.
It's meant for doing what you're doing, is what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And in fact, I would be using these eight videos, and these are all able to do. The big size, 2280 by 1900 or something. So like monster resolution.
Yeah. This is what Quadros aren't the fastest in the world. They're designed. I mean, they could be, but they were designed for graphics designers and very high resolution. I think that's a great choice for what you do.
And again,
the best choice.
Passively cooled. There's no fan on them. I've designed them so that airflow is out through the slots, and there's a slot empty between them so that there is a vent slot adjacent each of the heat sinks in order to allow the air to get out.
Cooling has really nothing wrong with what you're doing, but but water cooling has come a long way since I was doing it. And these are sealed units. They go in very easily. They have heat sinks specifically for various parts, and it couldn't be easier. It's a lot easier even than when we built our ultimate gaming machine 10 years ago. God,
and I guess it takes a lot less space, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, now it's a whole different. The game has changed quite a bit.
Right.
I'm interested that you're overclocking though, and you're not overclocking insignificantly. I mean, those are 3 gigahertz chips, right?
Yep.
And you're running them at 4.3 gigahertz.
Yep.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and they're running cool,
and it's reliable. Wow.
Yeah.
Did you bump the voltage a little bit to do that?
Definitely had to bring the voltage up in order to drive them that fast, but not up to a dangerous level.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, just shows you that chip has a lot of headroom.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. And I spent a lot of time digging around trying to see if there was any indication that there would be a shortening of the chip's life, pushing it higher and hotter. There isn't. It is all, Intel has all of this stuff set up dynamically. I mean, so one of the things I kind of maybe should have done is to go, rather than going 8 cores, maybe I should have gone to a quad core, and gone with was it a larger cache? It might have been even a higher speed in a quad core.
Probably, because, that's relatively slow. That rated speed.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And because the only thing I'm really thinking would be major video compression, like when I'm recompressing something that I do that from time to time, and that always takes a long time. So having, that's something that will pin all 16, because each of those cores is hyper-threaded, so there's 16 threads. And boy, when you bring up Task Manager and look at it, it's like, oh my God, it's like, 16 individual execution threads. In this thing, but they'll all get pinned FFmpeg, is now able to run massively multi-threaded.
You're going to get some great rendering performance out of this thing. That is awesome. Wow. Can I ask you how much?
I have no idea.
You've never added it up, wise man.
I didn't add it up. I just said I need one of these.
That's a man who does not have a wife, my friends. no one to answer to. Yes, I don't know. It cost what it cost. That's
I did. I took advantage of Newegg's and Amazon's nice return policies because I messed around with the RAM for a while. I got some RAM, and then it didn't go fast enough, I sent it back, and I got some others. And there, I had at one point three different sets of RAM that I was swapping around, trying to see if I like where the sweet spot was and what could I make it do and so forth, because it was, you know, a lot of patchwork. But everybody took everything back that I ended up not keeping, because, you know, that's part of the bargain.
Two really good retailers, I think. They're excellent. So Neo in the chat room saying that processor, you're not going to run more than, you can't run more than 64 gigs of RAM. He thinks you've maxed it out.
I do run 128. It works.
It worked. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It took it.
It took it. Although I just had to slow it down.
I had to slow it down to 266.
And I think you're not getting any speed benefit going from 64 to 128 gigs of RAM. So you might as well run, you know, it's
yeah, empty RAM is doing nothing.
Not doing anything.
Yes.
But I do see, if you're going to run, how many VMs are you going to run on this unit?
Well, I just don't want to not be able to run any.
Yeah, you could run 8.
Yeah, well, exactly. And so, you know, to be able to, like when I'm working on Squirrel, I need to be using Ubuntu because I want to make sure that it runs well under Wine. And so it's just nice to be able to have that open. And I'm probably going to end up with some sort of a browser in a box environment where I move Firefox into its own VM so that it you know, any games it wants to play there with malware, you know, can't get out. So anyway, so one of the goals was, because I've been feeling the limit of 3 gigs in my 32-bit system, I just said, okay, I want this to be the last thing I build.
This is not the same exact processor. You use the K, not the X, but 20 megs of cache. That's nice. That is
it had a lot of cache. And
nice.
Nothing is more important than cache. As we know, cache is king. And that's one of the nice reasons why having it, you know, only a few cores in use normally means that the large cache is designed for sharing, but there won't be sharing very much. Mostly, I'll just be able to open.
What is the X? I misread your BIOS. It's not the K; it's the X. So this says on the spec, it says 64 max memory size, dependent on memory type, 64 gigs.
Huh.
So send that RAM back.
Oh, you know, what I'll do is I'll just keep it because, I mean, I did have it in and I ran a memory test because I wanted to verify that it was solid.
Yeah.
So I know that it runs 128 gigs, even though, you know.
There's something wrong here. This can't be the same processor. I mean, it also says your max RAM is 2133. I don't know. This might be the wrong page.
Or maybe it's, you know, Intel being conservative.
Well, as they are, as they will be.
Yeah.
Nice.
What is
the monitor? You're going to use your existing monitors.
Yeah, I have some nice Dells. I've always liked Dell monitors, and I have, because my current monitors are DVI. There, it turns out that you could just do a little dongle, which is an HDMI to DVI.
Yeah.
And so initially, I will just use the little HDMI DVI converters to run the existing set of monitors. And then as I swap these monitors out, the new ones will certainly be HDMI. And then I'll just, you know, remove the little dongle.
Easy peasy. So, yeah, that's one issue we're going to have because it turns out the Oculus Rift needs the HDMI port. So we're going to have to use, some funky interface for the monitor. But you know what? You don't need a monitor when you're in the VR there.
Oh, and I did forget to mention that the Corsair power supply, the RM850.
Yeah, I think we got the same one. Yeah, very nice.
And that's about 200% the size I need.
Yeah.
Based on the calculations I did, I was like around 400 watts maximum. And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to give myself plenty of headroom because you don't want the power supply. In fact, the power supply's fan doesn't even run. And they warn you not to worry if the fan is not turning because it only spins the fan up when it needs to cool itself off.
Yeah, that's good.
So
how many watts in the power supply?
850.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those monsters, you can go all the way up into the 1200s or 1500s.
Well, that's the nice thing about Corsair. Unlike some of the brands, I mean, they're really they live up to their rating.
And it's modular, so you only plug the wires in that you need.
Right.
And Yeah, and very most nice. Of it's empty.
That's my job tomorrow. I'm now that the Oculus is coming, we have to put all the wires in.
Oh, well, actually, you got a nice case.
Oh,
your
I
case
love our case.
Allows you. You're able to run the wires behind the motherboard, mm-hmm. which is very nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep, I like that case a lot.
You know, I'll tell you, I learned long ago, buy a case for its ease of access.
Yes.
Because you know? That's something you're going to want.
It's like in networking, never tie down all the cables.
Right.
Because you think it's you're never going to change anything. You are always going to be changing something.
Well, good. Our engineers will be happy to hear that because I don't think we have any cables tied down in the basement there.
No, there's no point.
But what? We're going to be glad because in August we're going to unplug everything and move it. And yeah. I have a feeling that this time they will maybe trim it a little bit and make it look pretty. Right now it's a rat's nest down there. Steve, what fun. People don't build PCs that much anymore, but it is really a gratifying thing to do.
Oh, it is so nice.
I just look at that machine and think how well, OpenBSD would run on that thing. It would just be scream.
Oh my God, you could do an LS and it would just be a blur. All you'd see is the end. It's like, what happened?
Where's my listing? No, that's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of fun. My friend, we've come to the end of this early. You didn't do a 2.5-hour show. I'm very disappointed. You like Father Robert more than you like me.
We're right on our 2-hour mark, which is the sweet spot.
That's what we want to be.
Yep.
Steve Gibson's at grc.com, and so is so much good stuff, including Steve's super duper patented all night nonstop sleeping formula, which, by the way, now with taurine. No, wait a minute. Now with L-tryptophan. I keep getting boxes from Steve. Rattle, rattle. Oh. So should I eliminate the melatonin now that I got the L-tryptophan?
No. The L-tryptophan, I think, just is a nice little additional.
Steve, if my liver fails in a year, at least I'll be well rested. And that's how I'm thinking about this.
I got to tell you, Leo, I'm digging in on this. I haven't figured out what it is.
I can't sleep. Oh, I will say this. It is the best jet lag formula ever. So even if you don't want to, use it on a regular basis, when we went to New York, I was in bed on time. I was up on time. I was instantly on East Coast time. And Lisa and Michael were, 12 and noon. They're... But I was up at 6 or 7, and I was – I mean, from now on, I'm not traveling without that thing. That is great.
There's something for me that happens after – I think it's about between 8.5 and 9 hours. If I go to bed early so that I can get that much, it's almost mystical the next
nice.
Day.
Yeah, life is
how
better.
I feel.
Life is better
it is
when you
like
sleep.
It's amazing.
Now, have you...
Go ahead.
Have you tried... I'm really tempted to open those capsules and make a little powder that I put in a cup of tea or something. Because it's now up to like 10 pills
or
something. It's a big handful. And I think it might be better if I had it in a beverage.
Yeah, I'll be surprised if... if someone doesn't come along and say, hey, we want to, turn this into an all-in-one, ready-to-go package, which would be great.
Well, as soon as you perfect it.
And yes, for what it's worth, I'm getting a lot of positive feedback. People who have not been able to sleep for years report that they're sleeping for the first time ever.
Yeah.
Even like college students are saying, hey, this thing works. And it's like, well, I'm just so happy.
Yeah. Knocks me out, and I sleep through the night, and I feel great the next morning and not groggy. But we're not selling it. It's just on the webpage. It's there if you want to know about it.
Just Google healthy sleep formula.
And, of course, while you're there, make sure you get the Never 10. Never!
That is a good name.
I'm telling you, great SEO. Really, really smart. Spinrite's also there. Good program too.
For a while, the other name I was tempted to go with, because we have GWX for Get Windows 10.
Yeah,
I was tempted to go with FWX, but I thought, I like Never 10. It's better.
WX is good, but I don't think you'd be in the Sydney Morning Herald with that one. No.
No.
Never 10 is perfect. So many things there. Just go to grc.com, browse around. Of course, the podcast there, the transcripts. You can get the show from our site, too, twit.tv/SN for security. Now, it's also on YouTube. It's also, you know, actually, if you go to youtube.com/twit, you'll see all of our shows, and you can subscribe to individual ones. Each of them have their own YouTube channel. And people keep saying, gosh, I wish you still did the reviews, the before you buy stuff. But what we do reviews on all the shows, and then we put them on YouTube, and there's a YouTube product reviews playlist, so you can, in effect, assemble your own before you buy if you want. And that's really kind of how we've, you know, handled that, is we've just moved it into this YouTube playlist. But it all starts at youtube.com/twit. The newsletter is at twit.tv/newsletter. Free. No ads in it even. I don't know why, but we just decided not to do that. Mainly because our great sponsors make everything possible. We thank them. And we thank you, Steve. And we'll see you next week. Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC on Twit. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Leo. Security.